Okay, everybody, thanks for coming out. I think we're going to go ahead and get started. This is the Rise of BlogEverity, and my name is Kyle Bunch. I'm the co-founder of BlogEverity. Our other co-founder, Jeremy Hermans, is sitting out there in the audience, so you can direct all complaints to him. And I'm going to go ahead and let our panelists introduce themselves one on down the line. So we'll start with Henry here.
My name is Henry Copeland, and I run a company called blogads.com that sells ads for many of the biggest bloggers. I am certainly not a blog everybody, but I know a number of them, so that's why I'm here.
My name is Amanda Congdon. I'm a video blogger for abcnews.com and also for starringamandacongdon.com, and I blog on amandacongdon.com.
My name is Karina Longworth, and I co-founded a film blog called Cinematical. And that blog was bought by AOL along with the network that it was part of in 2005, at which point I went to go work for the parent company. I currently work for Netscape.com, and I blog on my own at VidiaSea.com.
I'm Casey McKinnon, and I'm one of two executive producers of Galacticast, the other of which is over here, Rudy Chishan. And we act and edit and direct and write and everything. We make Galacticast. It's a weekly sci-fi comedy show. We also had a show called KitCast, which was a popular sex video podcast. And I also blog it and video blog at CaseyMcKinnon.com.
I'm Nick Douglas, and my mic is off. And I talk to myself at a site called LookShiny.com, and it's a personal blog. And I also am editing BlogEverity.
Which is, I don't know if I'm prematurely announcing, but which is coming back after having its first career a year ago. And I used to write for Valleywag, but then I got fired.
So just to real quick kind of sum up what we're going to do here, Henry's going to kind of take us through, as the kind of resident expert on blogging and statistics of the panel, take us through a lot of the current metrics that define blogging stardom and fame today, kind of shoot holes in a lot of them, and then we're going to kind of discuss our views on that, the relative experiences of the panel, and sort of talk about where we think things are going, and hopefully have enough time at the end for everybody to ask all the questions that they could possibly ask. So without further ado, I'll let Henry get into his little brief presentation.
Okay. So we're going to focus on two things, the Forbes Web Celeb Top 25 and also the Technorati Top 100 list, and kind of look at how flawed those are. The whole point of this is if there ain't no objectivity, then we're really in trouble because subjectivity is truly screwed. So let's take a quick look at, how do we get this to move?
Here, just,
totally screwed PowerPoint.
Yeah. We're going to call the man whose computer this is.
You broke it.
What's it doing?
it's something stuck.
Reverting
so
to the,
oh, not good. It looks like a scroll lock's probably on.
You shouldn't have called it totally screwed.
Uh-huh. We prematurely did that to ourselves, so hold on. Let's see if it functions. Scroll lock.
That's not good.
Okay, I'm just going to keep hitting this, and you can get a glimpse of that slide.
I'm going to give it to
me. It's all plugged in.
Okay, wait. Let me do this.
Oh, yeah.
This is why Al Gore used Keynote.
There we go. Okay, this is a really bad way of doing it, but now if you hit that baby right down there, what happens? Hit that little thing?
There's a peating pressure.
Yeah, but without.
Okay, so briefly.
We will post all of these online with the scroll lock off, so you can actually peruse through them yourself.
I'll just tell you a little bit about what I have in there. Forbes Web Celeb Top 25. Can I just pull it up here and read some of this? Okay. Yeah, there. This wonderful graph. What we've got up there is.
Yeah, just
we didn't want to do that.
It's that DST thing.
Okay,
we'll start over. Bottom line, the most interesting thing about the Forbes Web Celeb Top 25, as many of you probably saw it come out a couple of months ago, we had some very big bloggers in that. You had a fictional blogger being number one. She was a woman. Number two was a guy named Perez Hilton with 100 million impressions a month. Number three was a guy named Marcos Melitzis with 15 million impressions a month. And then you worked your way slowly down to number 23, a guy named Jason McCabe Calcanis. How many of you know Jason McCabe Calcanis? Yes, okay. So he is famous. How many impressions do you think he gets a month? 80,000 impressions a month. So the conclusion is that to be famous on the web, or at least to be famous for Forbes, you do not need to have a hell of a lot of impressions. You don't need to have a hell of a lot of readers. You just need to know a reporter, and you need to be quotable. So that's lesson number one. And I had a really sexy picture of Jason, the famous one with Jason and his dog looking like Napoleon, which you won't get to see. So that was the top 25. The next list that we deconstructed was the Technorati Top 100. Within that top 100, there are roughly seven blogs, quote-unquote, with names in foreign scripts that I can't read. That's helpful. No problem there, but I wouldn't regard those as terribly useful to me as an American trying to figure out what are the top blogs I want to read. Another seven of them are services like My Blog Log. Again, not terribly helpful if I'm trying to evaluate what are popular and interesting blogs. We also have blogs with perhaps 400,000 impressions a month 400,000 impressions a month being the blog number 60, a guy with 50 million impressions a month being blog number 80. Bottom line, the numbers are totally meaningless. The problem for us, the problem for everybody, is that these numbers become ossified in the public consciousness, and everybody out there refers to the Technorati Top 100. I had a famous blogger said to me the other day, the only reason I blog is to make it into the Technorati Top 100. I'm like, you know, it's the most ruinously fallacious piece of crap, and yet you want to be in there. So all of this is simply to set up the idea of, okay, if the statistics are so busy lying to us and if it's impossible to really know what's going on, what then are the measures and how should we be thinking about blogeberty?
Which then takes us to the sort of subject of the panel that we're going to try and delve into of what really defines internet fame and blogging stardom. And I think we'll just kind of go on down the line and ask each of the panelists how they sort of review what they would call their A-list, their top bloggers, the people that they refer to the most and most regularly. And I guess Henry sort of kick things off. Henry, do you have any thoughts to share real quick about what you think is the best?
I had a great graph for you that involved having big circles, and the idea I have is that there are whole bunches of different, what we call probably hives. You can call them networks. And the old publishing model was very hierarchical. You had a few stars, and you had an awful lot of wannabes. In fact, now you have, there's Jason's. Let's just show Jason's picture just so we can all have a chuckle. There he is. Jason's, now this is Forbes. Jason's personal blog is one of the most popular on the web. That's total, utter bullshit. Jason has 80,000 impressions a month. In fact, let's just look really briefly here. The thing really driving the Forbes list is, do you live on the coast and are you a male? Those two things greatly impact your ability to be a web celeb, according to Forbes. Now, I'll just go quickly here. This is, I think, the new universe. This is the left is the Democratic blogosphere in 2004 election. The right is the Republican blogosphere. Basically, you've got stars in all these different blogospheres. And the whole idea of a single monolithic top 100 list is total. It's breaking down. It's meaningless. So, you know, you've got music bloggers. You've got Scott Lapatine, conservative bloggers. You've got Michelle Malkin. It totally depends on what field you're playing in.
I think for me, I mean, it's about where I see them and how often I see them. Am I seeing them not only, you know, in the blogosphere, but am I also seeing them, you know, are they writing books? Are they on television? Are they quoted in newspapers? I think that it has to do with kind of full coverage. That's kind of how I guess evaluate. I don't necessarily really do that very often, but when I think about, like, Jeff Jarvis, for example, is a good example of a blogeberty.
Well, two things. I mean, for me, I guess people that I think of, they're the blogeberties that are people like Arianna Huffington, who are people who are not initially famous for blogging, but who get a large amount of traffic to their blogs because they're already a known quantity. But then other than that, I come from the film blog world, which is a totally separate place from tech blogging or political blogging. I'm sure that most of you guys don't read a lot of film blogs because they can get, you know, pretty arcane, and they're pretty much just for people who are really into film. And as far as that goes, I mean, I think the biggest, you know, film blog star in the world is this guy, David Hudson, who writes the blog for Green Cine Daily. And, you know, I think he's fantastic, and I think he writes by far the best film blog in the world. But, you know, he's not on this panel.
Sorry.
I don't really pay attention to much things other than video. So for me, when I think of, you know, celebrity video people, I think of, you know, Zay Frank and Ask a Ninja and that sort of thing. And it's funny because it's kind of unfortunate because it seems like we're kind of considering people celebrities only because they've been in the New York Times, you know? So as soon as you've been in the New York Times, then everyone kind of goes, oh, they're a celebrity now. So kind of sad because we're all new media, but we're all relying on old media to tell us who is a celebrity.
The great irony there is, like, when you get in the New York Times, when's the last time you were in the New York Times?
Who, me?
Yeah.
In another life, perhaps?
Oh, I thought you would said it because you were totally, like, trying to imply. And, by the way, when I was in the New York Times, that's what I would do. But anyway, like...
Amanda was.
So, yeah, don't you think, Amanda, like, when you got in the New York Times in one article, you look at it and you're like, that's cool, and then you realize... Oh, 10 times as many people watched my show as read this article in the New York Times. And yet, like, your cousin is going to, you know, call you up and say, like, you're famous now.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's now. That is kind of, it's weird because it's just weird the way other people that aren't reading blogs and that aren't, like, interested in new media perceive fame. And, you know, for me, my grandmother, when she saw me on Frontline the other night, that was huge for her. And, you know, whereas... A video blog still doesn't quite make sense. So, right. I don't know though. I think it is a big milestone to make it to, you know, the New York Times, or I really believe in the full coverage thing.
Cool. So what I would think of is some of the top bloggers. Since I'm a lazy person and a hipster, and so I like to find things that no one else has seen, except one other guy who's cooler than me and showed it to me. And so that's why I would say the real top blogs are a couple of those, like Waxy.org by Andy Bio and Femoculus by this guy Rex Sorgatz. Rex, sorry. These are guys who, they collect all these different pieces, kind of like Boing Boing, which more people have heard of, is able to collect things, but partially because Boing Boing has a fantastic tip line and because the bloggers use their own unique feel for what they like. Like, Rex may argue that he's only blogging what he likes, but what he likes happens to be what the next week everyone else is blogging about. Mm-hmm. And those are the people I really like, that they're not necessarily doing it to be this cool sort of innovator that gets written about in Fast Company magazine, but just because they like it. Yeah.
I think you guys sort of hinted at what I was driving at for the next point, which was looking at where things go from here with regards to video. And obviously there's been a huge explosion, and Amanda and Casey and now Nick have all gotten in on this. Karina's been involved on video blogging. And at the same time, as they said, all of them have text blogging experience too. But I'd love to get anybody's thoughts on what the future holds, how many... You know, obviously TV stars are a lot bigger than most authors out there, and we aren't necessarily a nation of readers per se. We're very driven by those moving images. Do you think that this is going to really impact the popularity of text bloggers long term? Do you think that we're all just going to be watching video blogs with only the very best really getting any sort of readership on the text side? Or do you think there's still going to be a lot of room for text and audio and video to all live together?
Well, I mean, they're still books. And there's, you know, still there's TV and books, and they live harmoniously for the most part. But yeah, no, I think that just the fact that three out of the five people on this panel announced, you know,
that would be six of us, actually.
Sorry, six of us. I can't count. But we're all, like, most of us are video bloggers. I mean, that says a lot. I think that. A lot of bloggers have started a lot earlier than Casey and I, for sure. And yet, because obviously it's a visual medium, we're more recognizable.
it's kind of okay that you didn't count me in that list because I've done video, but I don't really feel comfortable with it. I mean, I came into blogging as a writer, and I mean, I guess I just hope that there's not going to be a requirement that all blogs have to suddenly be video blogs because I'm not a born performer, and I think that there are a lot of people out there that are more naturally writers than are people like Amanda.
But I feel as far as the cult of personality, that's going to happen a lot more to video bloggers because in writing, it's something that you're searching. A lot of more of the traffic is people who are looking for a term and came over. But with video blogging, it's hard to like trip on a video blog unless someone is showing you, like, here's this fun video person. And then there's also, yeah, the face that you recognize and can come up to in the street and harass. It's fun to do that.
I sort of keep jumping around here, but there was another point in there that kind of takes us into the next slide and I think is really important to touch upon, which is how much any of the overall popularity that having a huge audience matters versus having a smaller, maybe more devoted audience. And as Nick said, a lot of times a huge audience is because you're well search engine optimized and you're getting a lot of people that happen to just be looking for the same term. So I'd love to get any thoughts from anybody on the importance of quality versus quantity. I know this was a debate that Zay Frank and Rocket Boom after Amanda left sort of waged a little bit, and I'd love to kind of continue some of that discussion here and get your guys' thoughts on quantity versus quality as far as audience numbers and audience level goes.
Speaking as someone with 600 people only watching me, quality is totally important in the quantity.
I really believe in quality as well. And I mean, even just, you know, picture quality, sound quality, you know, things that we're still working on, but, you know, obviously, you know, we're not professional filmmakers, so it takes a while to get into it. But also, you know, trying to make the video look better online and bigger and, you know, as everything becomes cheaper, just making it more like TV, basically, but without the bureaucracy.
Can I speak up for quantity? No, I'll actually speak up and bash TV a little. I stole the mic.
You go, man.
No, I would assert that, you know, if we're just replicating TV, we're in trouble. And it's fun. It's good. It's certainly good to subvert the traditional television hierarchy and screw the networks. But that, you know, Web 2.0 is all about kind of communities intermingling, and that one can argue that the star culture is actually harmful. And you have, you know, the best of what's going on online are these communities, Metafilter, Daily Coast, places where people really create some kind of new ideology, some new momentum. You know, Yearly Coast there's going to be another Daily Coast convention this year called Yearly Coast out in Chicago. Last year you had about 2,000 people. Next year you may have 5,000 people. You're going to have a whole bunch of presidential candidates showing up out there. So there's something also that goes on in which a community takes on its own power and becomes the celebrity.
Which I guess sort of leads us to a point that maybe we should have opened with. But really, I guess, what's the importance from being a blogging celebrity of, as we talk about, your ability to make revenue from it, your ability to wield influence from it, to build community? What are we trying to do here with all of this? You know, as individuals, as people promoting themselves, you know, a lot of people, I think Steve Rubell being one of them at Hugh McLeod, have really emphasized the value that a blog can have for you as a professional promotional tool, that you may not necessarily be read widely, but you're read by people who matter in your industry, who may hire you, who may, you know, whatever. As that relates to blogging and fame, are we going to see potentially a divergence where we define that celebrity as someone who, you know, is very authoritative within a community? And sort of trying to lead to some sort of question, and Nick, maybe you can take it a little bit from here.
Yes. for a lot of us, there is a really good goal of, and it's actually a great measure, how much will your audience stand you selling them out? Because if you do it in the right way, it's not really selling out anymore. It's being clever and monetizing. And that's why Henry, what's the name of the cartoons? Hugh McLeod. Hugh McLeod has these cartoons that he draws, little cynical scribblings on the backs of business cards. But he's also selling prints. He's identified himself with a winery. He's really just made himself a whole brand. And yet it doesn't feel cheesy the way that it does when you watch, you know, Schwarzenegger in Japanese nicotine drink ads, where you're like, you feel kind of bad about the dude. Whereas Hugh McLeod is able to identify himself with someone else's brand in a really classy way, which is why one reason I think more people know his name than maybe his traffic would determine.
And I guess maybe just going on down the line, I'd love to hear everybody just talking about that motivation that drives them. And I know that we're not all just trying to become blog everybody's trying to become famous, but
speak
but obviously
for yourself.
but obviously that, you know, as it relates to celebrity and as we sort of coined this very awkward phrase, you know, it's really about gaining that level of access to things in the world, gaining the ability to go where you want, to do the things you want and talk to the people you want. And, you know, Amanda being a great example of somebody who's gotten to talk to a lot of really important people through that exposure, whether it is through traditional media or whether it is raw audience numbers. So as all of you guys obviously devote a lot of time to this, what is it that drives you guys as you know, to gain that level of notoriety or whatever you want to call it?
I think you kind of hit it on the head for me. It's access. I mean, that was one of the main reasons that I decided to go with ABC News after Rocket Boom, was that I would have access to a lot wider range of people to interview and meet. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that drives me is the ability to say, hey, if I wanted to pull out of mainstream altogether, I could make a great living just online independently. And so now I'm kind of, what I'm doing is a hybrid thing where my personal site is sponsored, and I'm also doing, you know, ABC. So I'm kind of testing the waters on both ends, and I love the flexibility that I guess that's what drives me.
When I started at Cinematical, I was not aware that there even was a blogosphere. I really didn't know that I, you know, was going to be part of something that would be talked about, you know, in these terms ever. I was in graduate school and I needed a job writing about movies, and so I took it and I did it, you know, 16 hours a day for a year, and then I had, I think, a decent amount of influence over other blogs and, you know, in the indie film community, I was fairly, you know, well-read and whatnot. But at the same time, I had no health insurance. I could barely pay my rent. I had, you know, $60,000 in student loans. So when I got an offer to take a corporate job, I took it. And, I mean, in some ways, I do miss, like, having that influence and being part of the daily conversation about movies. At the same time, I like going to doctors. So, I mean, I wish there was a way that I could have both worlds, but nobody's made that offer to me yet. So,
I think what drives Galacticast is audience participation. Because, you know, we do pretty much everything we do is for free. And, you know, we try to make some sponsorship, and we've been doing that recently. And that is so rewarding, to get sponsorships from fans or viewers. And just to get comments and to get emails and audience suggestions for episodes. Another thing that was really exciting recently is that one of our viewers / friends / fan, whatever, we had a wish list, and the wish list had all these, like, goofy things that we just really wanted. So, lunch with Robert Rodriguez, a video of Kevin Smith watching our show, and, well, basically, this man, Tim Shea from Next New Networks, went out and you know, stopped Kevin Smith at the New York Comic Con and showed a video of our show to him while having someone else videotape it, and then he sent it to us. So he won instant producer credit on our show, which normally producer credit would be $500 donation. So in this case, it was so rewarding on both sides. You know, we're just so excited about it. So right now we actually have people trying to get us lunch with Robert Rodriguez, but I can't promise anything.
He's here today. You could probably
find him. I know, but you know, does he? I don't know. We'll see what happens.
He seems like the kind of guy that would go out to lunch with you.
Yeah.
I'd like to think that.
And then he'd make a really cool 5-minute film about it without using any tripods or anything. It was pretty cool, this video of Kevin Smith watching the video, because he's surrounded by these stormtroopers. Yeah, because he was at some convention and the conventioneers had decided to be his bodyguards. Like, Kevin Smith really needed, like, bodyguards around him.
Oh, who doesn't want stormtroopers as their bodyguards?
Who doesn't want? But want, need, can afford.
Now, we'll be real blog-ebrities once we have our stormtrooper entourage.
So I basically blog for the fame and the money, but also because of what I saw in Zay Frank when he was video blogging was, and this is the same reason that I liked writing at Blogebrity and at ValueAg, was it was something that I would yell at my friends about and bore them, and then I could bore like thousands of people a day, and it was thrilling, and that's what I'm shooting for.
One of the challenges that we've discussed in the past, I've discussed with some of the people on this panel and other people, a lot of times as you make a name for yourself as a blogger, much like any sort of celebrity, there's the potential to get kind of typecast, where you know, despite having a full range of creative ideas, people start to know you for being the guy who writes about tech on ValueAg or being the Rocket Boom girl or whatever. Can you guys talk about any experiences you guys have had with that, and or maybe tips for anyone out there that might experience it themselves as to sort of how to transcend maybe their initial success and the thing that they're initially known for to become somebody who can be more multi-dimensional as a public personality?
Never introduce yourself as formerly from blank. That's the number one tip. But I've had that situation, and I think the big thing for me was I was writing the shows. I was writing Rocket Boom, but no one knew that. So it was always, oh, she's the face of Rocket Boom, and that was always really hard for me to take as a, you know, kind of diehard feminist. So I don't know, other than just not introducing yourself as, I always say, you know, a writer and video blogger. If I'm going to go for more than just video blogger, I'll list out all of them: video blogger, writer, actress, producer. And so that kind of gives an idea. I think if you really just lay it out on the line, all the things that you do.
I don't have a good answer for it. I guess I'm still figuring it out. I mean, I still get publicists contacting me several times a day asking me if I'll post stuff on Cinematical. So maybe, you know, in another year after I haven't been running that site, that'll stop.
Well, since I actually started by the name Ms. Kitka, and that's been a really hard name to shed. I often have people going, oh, right, you're Ms. Kitka. So it's kind of, I've started branding my name, you know, and telling people I'm Casey McKinnon, and also for Galacticast. A lot of people refer to me and my boyfriend as Galacticast, but we try to say, no, we're Casey McKinnon, Rudy Chichan, Casey McKinnon, Rudy Chichan, because, you know, we have other projects in the works, and, you know, we're going to, you know, we may move on to other shows, and, you know, while doing Galacticast or whatever. So, you know, we don't want to just be known as Galacticast, and that's how we do it. Just try to brand our name, make sure we get our own websites and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I hate being labeled with the name of the site that I'm on as well, because when I was doing ValueAg, I would go to these little tech parties full of the sorts of awful people who read ValueAg, and they were like, I could say, I'm Nick Douglas, and yeah, I write this site. It's a gossip site about tech. It's called ValueAg. You're ValueAg! And I was like, I know I'm not ValueAg. ValueAg's a site. Someday I'm going to get fired. And I was, and now I'm not ValueAg. But it's good, actually, maybe to pick a name. Galacticast seems weird to call two people. But I tried to pick, like, by saying, picking the name Look Shiny. I'm hoping no one's going to be like, you're Look Shiny. It doesn't really roll off the tongue. But it depends on, like, how much your show is personal, don't you think? Like, Galacticast isn't you pouring out your, like, inner banalities.
We do have a lot of shows where it's just Rudy and I doing, like, crazy sci-fi things going on in our lives. So, cool. Yeah, we have the parodies, which, you know, we play other characters, but we also have the shows where we actually play Rudy and Casey in these weird sci-fi situations. So, yeah, I mean, like, we are Galacticast.
Right,
it's just
right.
We
don't want
to get away from that, and for people to see that, you know, we have this other talent. Like, we are writers and producers and editors and whatever. We do it all ourselves. And we want people to hire us for other things, or, you know, so we do need to brand ourselves as Casey McKinnon and Rudy Chichan.
Now I understand. I'm fine with being Look Shiny because I have nothing else. Oh, and Blogebrity.
I mean, and also, I think it depends on how much of a hit the thing that you're associated with is, because, I mean, I've had the same domain name for my personal blog for like 4 years, but nobody has ever, you know, met me at a party and said, oh, right, videocy.com. It's always been Cinematical. And that's because I have 4 unique users on my personal blog.
How many of you own your own domain name?
I do, but I don't use it.
I mean, with your name. I've always found it really
hard. There's this stupid bass player named NickDouglas.com. There's this awesome bass player, if this is getting podcasted.
When he was blogging, one of my favorite bloggers was Nick Denton. Yeah. I always found it incredibly ironic that he owns the .org but not the .com.
I think Jason Calacanis actually owns NickDenton.com.
He tells everyone he does, but and that he's, right.
And that he's
trying to extort him with it. But
yeah, all lies.
Sorry, just taking a little note. One sort of interesting anecdote that I can share that really led us to found Blog Everty in the first place, the idea behind it and making this comparison between bloggers and celebrities was something that happened to me actually when I ran into Tony Pierce who's in the crowd here today, one of the early great bloggers and an LA-based blogger who now writes at LAist, and I saw him out at a show in LA and was literally too starstruck to approach him. And I know that probably makes me sound like the ultimate geek, but it was the truth. I mean, it was being in LA, I see celebrities a lot of times, and some of them are famous, but you don't really like them, and then some of them you really like, and you don't want to approach them and make an idiot of yourself, and I had that exact experience with Tony. Which sort of brings me to how often do you guys have celebrity-type moments where you're out in public and people come up to you and approach you, whether it is at parties or just, walking down the street? Have any of you guys had those sort of moments, or do people like me just sort of linger in the background and lurk out and not say hi?
Yeah, it happens. I think it's funny because it happens in certain places more than others, like New York City. If ever I'm in New York City and I'm walking on the street, that I'll get stopped. But if I'm, in Connecticut or New Haven or somewhere else, it's very unlikely. I can just be like a hidden. And especially when I did A Man Across America, I did a tour across the U.S. interviewing bloggers and environmentalists this summer. And, when I was in between California and the East Coast, it was very few people knew me or, knew what I did or anything like that. So it's funny that it's like regional or something. But then also, obviously at conferences, at tech conferences, and then I was really kind of surprised. I was at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, last week, and I'm pretty openly liberal, and I had some conservative fans. I was excited about that.
It doesn't really happen to me at all, except for at film festivals.
For me, it happens at conferences usually, so not too often. I mean, I live in Montreal, and there's, Canada doesn't really follow podcasting very much. But my boyfriend's been recognized as Superman, and I get autograph requests for Queen Kong because there's a lot of people who like giant women. There's a fetish for giant women out there, so.
Wow.
I'm not going to try to top fetishes for giant women.
It's tough. And I guess the follow-up question for any of you would be, is it always a great thing to be approached like that, or is there ever times where maybe it does start to be like the celebrity who gets bothered a little bit, and you're having to, mingle with people that are sort of asking for your time at the worst times, interrupting a conversation or what have you?
The only time I find it a problem is if I'm about to go speak somewhere and I really need to, organize something. Otherwise, I love it. I absolutely love talking to people and getting feedback from a real person, not just, a comment. But I also respond to mail that I get, any kind of fan mail, not all of it, but if I get a piece of email, if I get an email that makes my day, I'll write back and say, wow, thank you so much, that makes my day, or that's a really good tip, I'm going to totally use that, and I will, the next show, so.
It doesn't bother me. In fact, I really enjoy it, especially when filmmakers come up to me and talk to me about their movies, but I mean, I don't like being hit on, and that happens sometimes. I mean, I'm sure that people who do that are nice people, but I'm in a relationship, so that's all.
I think it's nice as long as they're not creepy. That's really about it. I mean, I get some guys.
You have a story, Casey?
Well, no, it's just recently there's been a burst of guys emailing me about Ms. Kitka, and they're like, oh, when are you bringing KitCast back? And that's like, well, you know, it's been a year that I haven't done that. So, you know, I've moved on and I'm doing GalactiCast and I love that. So, you know, hopefully they'll move on too.
Nope.
The times that I don't like people recognizing me is when they don't really recognize me and they think I'm my boss, who is also named Nick. He's named Nick Denton. And that causes confusion, especially since now he does write my site after firing me. And I also hate it when people say, oh, you have that show Look Shiny. Yeah, maybe I'll watch that when Zay's done with his show, which is fun. Well, one commenter actually summed it up best when he commented on my show saying, like, it's like Zay Frank, but not as funny or intelligent. He was right, but dude didn't have to say it.
One thing that Henry sort of touched upon during the whole technical snafu that was the first 5 minutes of this presentation was the imbalance that some of the technorotties and Forbes that obviously are flawed but are still reflecting as far as sex balance goes. And I think especially that Forbes top 25 to only have, you know, three women out of 25, 12%, that's obviously not representative of the population at large. Do you guys think that we'll see a shift in that? Is that just a byproduct of a flawed you know, report, or are we really seeing an imbalance, like a lot of people have said, where blogging is primarily a medium of certain, you know, a certain demographic that's largely white males?
I would say those methodologies are just incredibly flawed. I mean, if you look up here on stage, I mean, I'm not a celebrity, so, and you're not, so, you know, 75% of the folks up here are women, and that there is, you know, there's the cult of personality is going to accrue very often to attractive, funny women.
Anybody else have any thoughts on that balance, and if it's going to change, or if it has changed and the media is just slow to catch on?
Well, I wonder, from looking at that 12% thing, if what kind of blogs are the popular ones, if it's the tech ones or whatever, and perhaps there's a smaller percentage of females in the tech industry and you know.
Well, here's the list. So the first one's fictional. The second one is Perez. I mean, we've got to go down to
I mean,
Amanda.
Perez does call himself the queen of all media.
Is he part of the 12%?
No. So you've got Amanda at number 8. You've got Shani at number 16. Then you've got Violet Blue at number 25.
Which is bullshit, because Jenny Jardin is responsible for half of everything that happens on the internet. She writes it boing boing.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
So it's a very tech-centric and media-centric list. I think basically you had to know a journalist to get on this list. You know, that's, I mean, and you're starting a star. We go back here. But number truly is not celebrity blogger on the internet.
Going back to what we were talking about, he has that alpha really important.
On his side, I really like.
Too heavily on this. The technorati totally off, but I think a lot of we look at seem to keep coming back, you know, that there isn't distribution and to tackle what's really of that quality versus, you know, who's listening and service comment on something. So yeah, Apple is important, and is, and how people repeat it. And I mean, 1,000 because I feel like significant repeating it or message elsewhere. And
also, don't you think, like, does it work? Like, this really, like, growing up as, no, in
Paris.
Out of a car without the world. Anyways, Smith, any media, certain men, how many people consume some media, and how much news for a week when so little action. She was a huge movie, land, you know, so really, if fairness of like everybody's be a real one up on.
Well, and part of you do now, I think, I mean, conventional is just no way of knowing. I mean, theory about the is it kind of the outside, anybody can rise, anybody still have the conventional word of mouth. My friend said this is type of thing is still
and that you never win your war.
I'm just interested by it. I mean, me up.
I guess this is back to that notion of access and odd metrics that we talk about are determine what level of access you might have. And so, you know, just to kind of try to frame this like there, you know, I think that a lot of it is that who's getting invited to conferences, getting to talk to politicians is largely being determined by the different systems that we're talking about seem to have a lot of flaws. And so, you know, how going forward can we, you know, hopefully do these things get fixed so that, you know, the people who are gaining access are not just the people who happen to be buddies with other people in the media, and this doesn't kind of continue to be the old boys club kind of thing, or, you know, where it's very still insular, that we embrace this idea of democratizing the medium. Which I guess sort of brings me to the last thing before we open it up to questions, which is kind of just a general question for anybody who has thoughts about, as especially things like more and more internet making it to TV, more and more devices allowing a lot of these video podcasts and things to converge with the traditional media, how much convergence can we expect as far as these personalities go? When do blog everities and celebrities start to become one, you know, all in one IMDb or one database of personalities, or do they always sort of stay separate?
Well, I mean, I think for me, I'm in the process of developing a TV show for HBO that's also going to have daily original online content. So I think maybe it will happen when that happens. But I think it's soon. I think that internet culture is becoming more and more mainstream. And I don't know if how we feel about that exactly, but I think that as kind of the two cultures converge, and of course they're not going to completely converge, but as they do, that we're going to see more and more blog ebbities be real celebrities.
And then I guess the follow-up, which somebody made an interesting point about, I think the guy who made MySpace the movie and then went on to sign a deal with Fox or whatever in developing his own show, and obviously the levels of control that you cede when you start to work with the bigger media. Long-term, you know, much like what the record industry is going through, where a large artist could really produce and release his own album and not have to give those large chunks, do you think we'll start to see those sort of things where a traditional celebrity shuns that relationship with bigger media outlets because they already have the notoriety to bring in a big audience to make that money?
Well, there's Tom Green, kind of, eh?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a success story.
But yeah, I mean, do you guys think that, I don't know, the person who I would love to see blog the most would probably be someone like, say, Chris Rock. Like, would Chris Rock ever say, you know what, I'm tired of working with networks that are going to force me to say this and that and to tailor my message to fit their direction. would people like that ever just, I'm going to just go start my own site where I'm going to put up my own video and do those things? Or is that, you know, always going to kind of...
There's also Dan McVicker, who he's from the Bold and the Beautiful. Anyone? Yeah. And he actually started the Late Night Mash, which is sort of like a late night talk show. So he started that and, you know, went from soap opera star to video blog star. So, I mean, he's still doing movies and everything. He's you know, cross-platform.
One thing that's going on right now is a site called superdeluxe.com, which is Ted Turner funded, and a lot of really big comedians and just sort of funny actors, like people like David Cross and Richard Belzer, and 100 other people that you've heard of that I can't think of right now, they're basically producing original content for that site, like original shows, and they're not getting paid by Turner to do it. They're doing it basically so that they can connect with fans. Like, Turner will give them enough money to, like, buy a camera if they don't have one, but they're not getting paid a salary. So that kind of thing, it's like, I mean, if there are artists out there who are frustrated working in mainstream media and, you know, they're given an easy way to put content online, then they're going to do it, I think. But I don't know if necessarily like somebody like David Cross would, you know, start his own blog and like really do it as his main thing.
There's still such a stigma in Hollywood though about like online content, and like I'm always surprised that certain celebrities would prefer to be in a reality TV show than make their own video blog that they could get sponsored and
have
do whatever
creative
the heck
control
they
over.
Want. Yeah.
Another thing I'm interested in is how IMDb is going to broach the subject of online content, because at the moment I've heard that you either have to be in a film festival or you have to be on broadcast television to be listed on IMDb. And so there's a lot of people who just want to get into a film fest, just try to get into film fest so they can be on IMDb. But of course, you know, with video blogging, video podcasting, you know, those will be available on Apple TV. They're already available on TiVo and Akimbo. So, you know, it's available on TV. It's not quite broadcast, but, you know, where will they draw the line and when will they start to accept shows? So.
Okay. Well, I think with that, we're going to throw it open to audience questions. So if you have a question and want to make your way towards a mic, or if you're lazy and you just want to stay seated, we can repeat your question. Let me start with him since he's been standing up there for a few minutes, but we'll get to everybody as much as we possibly can.
This all just seems like a bunch of talk to me. I mean, like, Henry, you have the numbers. Who's making the most money? Is it those three? You know what I mean?
But is it about, again, making the most money? I mean, is that what we would define, like, the biggest celebrities as the biggest money makers?
Isn't that how they rank celebrities? Who's $20 a picture or $20 million a picture?
I think that's the difference between online world.
There are celebrities that are broke, but you don't know it.
Who?
Because they all get their they get their designers to put on to wear their dresses. Yeah,
I agree with you. I mean, I think that it is largely all talk, but I mean, it's as I said, like I had to basically stop blogging because I couldn't like afford it. So.
Well, that's why, to me, page impressions is a really, really nice apples-to-apples-to-apples number. And again, if you look at this, I mean, again, I read – Jeff Jarvis is one of the few blogs I read almost daily. So I'm not bad-mouthing Jeff at all here. But, you know, you got Drudge with 500 million, and you got Perez with 100, and then you know, those are real numbers. That's mind share.
Oh,
I mean, we've got 1,300 blogs. I'd say we've got 1,300 blogs. I'd say about 200 of them. Yeah.
But when you talk about page hits, a person could get 100 million page hits, but especially with a video blog, when they subscribe to an RSS feed, the person almost never goes back to the site. So you could have hundreds of thousands of people visiting the site every day, but it would never be a page
right.
hit because
yep.
of video.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's why we can't name like the one most popular blogger, because no one fucking knows.
No one really publicizes.
So while we're talking about celebrities, one aspect of interactive and everything that goes on with this show I really enjoy is the accessibility. So we're talking about access to people who are now considered celebrities. And I'm wondering, it seems like the tides might be changing. When are bloggers and blog everybody's going to become accessible, relatively accessible? There's only so many email so many requests you get before you start having to trim that away. So I'm wondering if you're starting to see trends, and if so, where do you think we're going to be next year?
I mean, have you guys had any experiences with that of not being able to respond to email very, I mean, Amanda, I imagine you probably get a lot of...
I mean, it happens, but I think that, I guess everyone has their own breaking point when you start getting overwhelmed and you can't respond to everything, but I think you can still respond to some things. Like, I've gotten that question before, and I still think that you can respond to a percentage, or if you can only respond to 10 fans a day or whatever it is, you can still do 10 fans a day when you have millions and millions of fans. So.
And I guess part of the other thing is how many people are doing this that don't want that level of interactivity, you know, who don't, I mean, that's part of the medium is that, you know, things like comments tend to be built into a lot of these systems we use. So if you really don't want to interact with people, I mean, I think that may largely keep the responsiveness there to some extent. Obviously, some people, I know when I was trying to get, say, Frank on this panel, it was incredibly difficult for him to find time to respond to an email, and he actually ended up encouraging me to call at one point because the volume of email that he has to sift through just doesn't really make it practical to keep getting back to people in a really timely manner. But, you know, I think, so yeah, I would hope that would have a positive impact on that. That is, when you've got comments and things built in, you want to respond, you want to interact with people.
Yeah, and speaking of that, when Zay found that he was getting too many comments on his show, because he couldn't, you know, watch all of that, he moved it into a forum. And so then instead, people are sharing, like, a lot of the questions people have for Zay don't have to be answered by Zay, like another person who's been with his show longer. And so really, you can pull all that access that people try to get to the people that they watch or read and enjoy and get them to share it with each other. So basically, we make better fan clubs for blogebrities than normal celebrities are able to.
And I guess the interesting follow-up to that is watching some of the traditional Hollywood. I know when 30 Rock, the show, had its first episode, Tina Fey was on blogging and very, like, live blogging through the first episode and responding a lot to comments. So I think we're even seeing traditional media embrace this as a way to interact more with fans. And I almost wonder if it might, you know, be that other side where you can't afford to not provide that level of interaction, because, I mean, how much more fulfilling is that versus someone who you know would never talk to you, would never respond to anything, you know? So I think a lot of it will be dictated by the audience and what they want, and if they really want this, there may be no choice but to keep responsive.
Yeah, I had a question about how you guys distinguish between what you would consider, like, professional content. Like, I mean, you know, news media organizations have certain standards of professionalism versus amateur, or I guess, like, sort of blogging as a hobby. Like, how do you guys, I mean, it seems to me you guys are basically consider yourself professional bloggers. And how do you draw that line?
Can I throw out a distinction? I mean, there's another distinction here, not between professional and amateur, professional being someone who makes money, amateur someone who doesn't. The additional category would be corporate versus non-corporate. So you can either work for a big corporation, work for the man, or you can work for yourself. And in both cases, you're making money, but in one case, you've got a lot more artistic control. And to me, it's going to be awfully sad if the whole damn blog revolution ends up with everybody just working for the man blogging.
Yeah, but at the same time, there's also, you know, professional doesn't necessarily just mean making money by it. I mean, it's a certain level,
it's sometimes that you tell yourself, like, you're not doing it for yourself. Like, if it's a hobby, you're like, oh, I enjoyed doing that episode. Who cares if, like, my cat walked through the last panel and, like, ruined my Middle Ages background? And, that metaphor made no sense. But I think the wonderful thing about blogging in this way is that you can do things that accidentally become professional. And then you do have to decide. Like, even Zay Frank had no idea, I don't think, just how much of his life his show was going to start taking over. He started as a very casual thing where he just recapped some news and he had a little fun. But it's in... staying, I think there is that balance to find between, like, saying, oh, I'm going to do this for me, because Zay would occasionally, like, someone would be like, you need more songs. Oh, you don't need enough, or you don't have enough songs, or you have too many songs. And he said, screw it. I'm going to do whatever I feel like doing today. And if he does it really well, he can be professional by just doing what he likes really well. So it's, you can have both. You can cheat.
I actually said a comment about the metrics, and I'd be interested in your views about this. But so it seems to me your argument is based on the idea that page impressions are what celebrity is or something. I don't know. Or they're somehow...
It's an alternate.
Important.
It's but an apples-to-apples comparison.
And actually, I don't mean to... I think page impressions, if you had to rank them, is probably a pretty good one. But the first of all, I guess with respect to that, I wanted to also comment on what Susan said about loud downloads being a big issue for videos. And in fact, I think that was really the Zay Frank rocket boom argument. Zay Frank was talking about impressions. They were talking about downloads. But then Technorati, I think, I'm no technical expert, but I think it's objective in the sense that it's number of links and trackbacks, which would be really important for probably someone like Jeff Jarvis in the sense he may not get a lot of impressions, but somebody's quoting him a lot somewhere or referring to his blog. And then I guess the fourth one is number of mentions in alternative media. Seems like that would be really important too. But I guess when I think about it, not really so much as celebrity, but what influence your blog would have. And maybe partly I'm just driven by being scared that Drudge is so high.
Well, but, now,
I don't even understand how he qualifies as a blog.
I don't even know what Drudge is.
Well, that was really based on the web celeb 25, which I think technically wouldn't be. At the same time, I think Drudge does a lot of things that would be very blog-esque in terms of publishing content on a daily basis, publishing in that sort of semi-non-linear or linear fashion where you've got, the newest stuff at the top. I just think part of why this is important, I look at it in comparison to television where we really rely entirely on the Nielsen system. And great shows, maybe there's some Arrested Development fans here, like great shows that end up getting canceled because they don't perform well on this one level. And are we leading down a path where we're going to wind up with the same sort of flawed metrics that wind up with, people that are doing a great job not performing on this certain level, and or are we, as we reach the level to track downloads, track RSS a little bit more accurately, will we suddenly just solve all this? And web celebrity will be very trackable to a finite number, or will we just always sort of argue over methodology, and as a result, different people will defer to different things? I think that's what we're looking at, and I'm sorry we can't provide more answers for that at this point, but I think a lot of that's going to probably shape up over the next few years of technology development, and hopefully is something that we can all keep in mind as we go forward.
This question is a lot more pertinent to, video blogging than blogging in general. But, some of the more popular video blogs on the web have probably more viewership than some basic cable programming. And so when that happens, eventually there's going to be advertiser creep. And, I mean, it's started already. Amanda, I know you did something really cool with Dove. Mm-hmm. And a lot of video bloggers are getting into that game. I was wondering, as advertisers get into that game, what video bloggers tend to be very in tune with their audience. So I was wondering what the reaction that you guys have had from audiences when there are things that are done that are a little more overtly commercial as opposed to on the sidelines.
I think a lot of it has to do with, for me, I feel very lucky because I work directly with Blip. If you guys don't know them, blip.tv, great hosting and everything. Anyway, they helped me get in touch with Dove and with PalTalk, and it was great because I could work directly with with Blip and the advertisers to find something that would work best for my audience. And I think it's that kind of communication that doesn't happen on TV. I mean, you wouldn't have someone, you wouldn't have the star of Lost or whatever. You wouldn't have them working with the advertisers and trying to figure out, what would be best for the people that watch Lost. But for video blogs, we're seeing that happening. And I think that's really exciting because it gives creators so much control, and it gives the audience, the viewers and the participants, the ability to kind of voice like, oh, no more pre-rolls or whatever it is. I think it's exciting.
Do you think a relationship with someone like a Blip is integral to securing that kind of media placement?
No. I think that, there are people that will find, at Rocket Boom we got our ads on eBay. You can do it anyway, however you want to connect with an advertiser. I think that it's easier. long term if you're working with someone else.
But the great thing is we can do things other than advertising, like what Zay Frank did. I really like Zay Frank. But what Zay Frank did was...
You should play a drinking game every time he says Zay
Frank.
Yeah. You're going to be drunker than I am at most 9 a.m.s. Anyway, Zay Frank had this thing. His friend Eric Gavrilock helped him build this system called Gimme Some Candy, which is kind of like a sponsorship program. But unlike some other bloggers who are like, oh, here's my PayPal thing. Can you donate it to it? And like, no one feels really awesome like sticking some money in a PayPal and seeing nothing. But Eric Gavrilock built this thing for Zay where there were little duckies that would appear on the next day's show. And if you paid $10, your little ducky would be there. And you could make whatever text you wanted. A few people bought duckies and used it as ads saying like, here's my website. That's my text that shows up when you hover over the little ducky. But most people just sent little nice messages to each other. People felt really cool about it. Then Zay could talk about it on the show. It was just a really cool way to raise money without looking like a beggar and without looking like a sellout and making the page more fun. It was fun to see a huge army of duckies. And then to count through and be like, oh, that bastard made $2,000 today on...
We do something similar, actually. We have, when people sponsor us, when they give sponsor money, depending on how much they donate, they get a title and a credit in our show. So if you give $5, you're a best boy. And if you want to go up high, you know, $500, you get producer credit and you get a full screen credit and everything. So,
I think we've got one last question here, and then we'll just about be wrapped up. But.
Just wanted to make a comment that... I think one of the things that we're getting muddled in the discussion is the difference between actual celebrities or bloggabrities and people with influence who are bloggers. And I think that that's really important, especially when talking about creating business models, because there's a lot of inefficiencies within bloggers who have audiences, who are influential within their blogospheres and are not monetizing their blogs correctly. And so... you don't have to have the 15 million, 100 million a month in page views in order to actually be able to monetize and, you know, have a decent income from your blog. So that's something that should be dispelled as one of those myths, I feel. But also, I mean, metrics are an issue. And Mary Hoder, who is the founder of Dabble, had published on her blog some time ago, like, her idea. She actually worked with Technorati at one point, and... she had published some time ago a whole algorithm of what she, was out of conversations with people who do, you know, ranking and searching and everything, that has to go beyond page views, where influence, yes, their links are, you know, part of that, but then mentions and blogs and tags and all these other, you know, ways where you can be replicated on the web that can actually, you know, give a better, a more accurate way of showing how influential somebody is. So we haven't gotten there yet. And I think that what we're seeing is actually old media cases in new media. I don't think yet we have seen, because this is the question that I have, how many of you were funded from the beginning? I think that having money for promotion and at least access to a certain kind of, you know, somebody having dealing with the business part as opposed to just having to do everything makes a difference. So I'm asking how many of you had that where you just didn't have to deal with the business part?
And
you
yeah, that was totally me. I worked for a company.
Yeah, that wasn't me. I mean, Andrew Barron and I worked on the business together, and we, you know, started from scratch.
I'm still building a business with Rudy. We're struggling to get our GST number, which is, sorry, it's taxes in Canada. It's really tough setting up a business. And, it's been a year and a half that we've been doing this, so, yeah.
Yeah, getting paid at ValueAg was kind of cool to just get, like, a paycheck. But it's also thrilling to have to beg for your supper. But I don't have any success story yet on making money on my own site. If you look on it, there are no sponsors. There are no duckies yet. But there will be someday.
But yeah, I think as sort of a closing point, I think, you know, this starts to become so cliche in talking about this as a medium, but it is still very new. And I think that this is something we really have to keep in mind as we go forward and we measure that success of combining things like authority with the raw traffic that that the paying advertisers who are going to provide a lot of that access we talked about are going to look for, and that, you know, it's important for us to try and drive those and to try and hopefully reward the people who develop those and develop effective ways of doing that. And I guess we'll hopefully be back next year and see progress from where we are now. So with that, I thank everybody for coming out. Definitely thank all of our panelists who did a great job. And no thanks to Microsoft and PowerPoint whatsoever.